Hello everyone, I'm Amanda Belby, Managing Editor at Consultant360.com. Today I'm joined by Dr. Jamie Kaufman, the founder and director of the Voice Institute of New York and one of the world's leading authorities on acid reflux. She also co-authored the book Dropping Acid, The Reflux Diet Cookbook and Cure. You may have read or heard about a study recently about the effect of alkaline water and the Mediterranean diet on acid reflux. Dr. Kaufman is here with us to talk a little bit more about the study and how to better treat acid reflux. Thank you for speaking with us today, Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Amanda. It's a pleasure.
So the study compared non-pharmacological treatments with proton pump inhibitors, which are considered a standard treatment option for patients with reflux. What are your thoughts on nutrition-based treatments for reflux?
Amanda, I think that's a two-part question. And so the idea that proton pump inhibitors are the standard treatment needs to be analyzed and discussed a little bit. There is a recent VA study with about 6 million, that's 6 with an M, million participants, and they compared people treated with H2 antagonists, which are the Zantac and Tagamet, and cimetidine with proton pump inhibitors, as you know, the Nexium and the Prilosec and so on. And the mortality among the PPI people is 25% higher. The other article that's very, very important is a 2014 study done in Denmark. It was a national study of 10,000 people. And the conclusion of their study was long-term use of proton pump inhibitors is associated with an increased risk of reflux-caused esophageal cancer, to which I replied, duh, because all my patients come on proton pump inhibitors and they're not well. In addition to those two studies, which I think are probably the most important, there are studies that link long-term use of PPI, at least statistically, with kidney disease, heart attacks, bone problems, osteoporosis and osteopenia, so that the weight of evidence is beginning to mount that saying to somebody, just stay on these pills, you'll be on these pills the rest of your life, isn't good treatment. So the idea that proton pump inhibitors are the standard of care may be the case now, but in my practice, which is, if you will, the worst refluxers in America, my people come from everywhere, many of them with terrible respiratory disease, we no longer use proton pump inhibitors at all. So that's the second part of the question. What are your thoughts on nutrition-based treatment for reflux? And the answer is it's about diet and lifestyle. And so there are some key components. So you may be surprised, but the number one risk factor for reflux, number one, is eating late. Eating late with alcohol, which I guess could be number one and two. Making it the big meal of your day, making it number one, number two, and number three. Overeating and not having a decent breakfast or lunch so that the major refueling meal, maybe you go after work to do some shopping or to the gym to exercise. Then you get home and there's childcare. So if the food starts and the food cooking may start after 8 o'clock. In my opinion, almost everybody who has this pattern will have silent reflux during the night. So of all of the risk factors, number one is eating too late, and then you can add to that the other things, alcohol eating, overeating, and so on. It's interesting to me, I'm going to be 70 this year, and when I was a child, my mother put dinner on the table at 6 o'clock, like clockwork. There were no fast foods, there were no soda machines. We went out to dinner maybe once a month, and everything was local. We waited till July or August till the corn came in. And so there was in 1960, there wasn't so much diabetes, obesity, heart disease, osteoporosis, sleep apnea, asthma. And so we might make the reasonable assumption that these epidemics are all the same epidemic and that they've occurred during my lifetime. So the question about acid reflux, okay. So the number one is eating early and eating good meals throughout the day. Number two is don't overeat. Number three is stay away from excessive amounts of high fat. Fat makes the lower valve at the VLES relax and is associated with a reflux. Excessive amounts of caffeine as well. Nothing wrong with a coffee or two a day. But nutrition-based treatment is essentially the most important element. And for all intents and purposes, it's the most important element in all of the diseases I've mentioned, and certainly diabetes being among them.
Your book talks about other non-traditional nutritional options to cure reflux. What diets are best, and what are the best and worst foods for patients with reflux?
Well, the number one worst thing, it turns out, is soda pop or soft drinks. People may be surprised that in 1973, following an outbreak of food poisoning, botulism, effectively the FDA mandated that everything crossing state lines in a bottle or a can either be acid itself or be acidified, and they recommended a pH of 4.6. Interestingly, the FDA never said to manufacturers, do not put excessive amounts of acid. And there's a story that's all over the internet, it's been there for a long time, of a man who said he found a mouse in a diet Mountain Dew. And the defense of the Mountain Dew company was impossible. Mouse dissolves, bones, teeth, everything. So today, the acidity of most beverages is from 2.6 or 7 to 3.9. You never heard of anybody having found E. coli or gotten salmonella or anything from drinking anything in a bottle or a can. So now comes the explanation. Why is it so bad to drink acidic stuff? It turns out that the term acid reflux may be a misnomer. And here's why. When you reflux, up comes acid and pepsin, this highly aggressive molecule that causes inflammation and destruction of tissue. If you're a biochemist, you may do pepsinization to break down protein before you do anything further. So the enzyme pepsin is actually the bad actor that causes tissue inflammation and probably is also associated with the development of iridigestive tract cancers. There's a study by Nikki Johnston in which she showed in tissue culture that laryngeal cells exposed to pepsin showed up regulation of all the genes associated with squamous carcinoma. So when pepsin comes up, it attaches itself, say, to your esophagus or your vocal folds or your tonsils or wherever it does. And so there it is, you know, in the path of what you normally swallow. And pepsin needs acid to be activated. And sure enough, there you drink an energy drink, pH 2.9, and this puts the acid into high activity. The converse is also true. Pepsin dies at about pH 8. And so it's one of the reasons we recommend alkaline water. So for people who have acid reflux, whether it's respiratory reflux or esophageal reflux, whether it affects the esophagus with heartburn and indigestion, or the throat with postnasal drip and hoarseness and cough and sore throat, it doesn't matter. Eliminating soft drinks from the diet and adding alkaline water are really important. The second thing is low-fat diet. And low-fat diet means that you can't have hot dogs and hamburgers and cheese. So we put people on a diet that's basically fairly bland. We allow them to eat the chicken and fish and vegetables. We do limit condiments and vinegar, no citrus. The best fruits for this early, you might even call it a detox period, are melons and bananas. You know, oatmeal is great for breakfast. So the reason why the first book is called Dropping Acid, The Reflux Diet Cookbook and Cure, is we recognize that dietary acid was a major problem for people with reflux. And it's not that it causes problems in the stomach, but it actually helps damage the tissue on the way down. And we've seen patients, many, many patients with laryngeal cancer who never smoked a cigarette in their life, lifetime non-smokers. Of that population, and I bet in my practice I've probably seen about 300 over the last 40 years, 100% of them had abnormal reflux testing. So we think that you can get cancer of the throat without smoking, but not without reflux. And I know that's a bold statement. But we think that the best diet is lean, not too much red meat and so on, clean, not too many chemicals, green, everyone knows what that means, and alkaline, which means not too much acid, a reasonably high pH.
So what is respiratory reflux?
Well, Amanda, I've spent my career, I started out as a laryngeal surgeon. I had the fourth laser in the United States that could do surgery on the vocal cords and throat without any cutting. I saw patients from all over the country. By 1981, I had a national practice. And I just said to my colleagues, send me the patients you don't want, your complications, your problems. And as I began to examine these patients, I observed that many of them had inflammation in the larynx and inflammation in the throat. Things were swollen. And I began doing pH testing, which I got this idea of putting a pH probe in the throat, and sure enough found that people had acid reflux into the throat, in most cases without ever having any heartburn or indigestion. Over the course of the last many years, we've examined over 100,000 patients with reflux. That's what they came for. Of the 100,000 patients we've examined, less than 20% have heartburn or indigestion. Wow, I thought it was all about heartburn and indigestion. What do they have instead? They have postnasal drip, thick postnasal drip. It's not like allergies where your nose is running. Chronic throat clearing. The stuff gets on your vocal cords. You've got to get the stuff off before you go on. A sensation of a lump in the throat, difficulty swallowing, ear pressure, sinus problems, and of course breathing problems. All listeners should know that the first question asked to somebody who might have asthma is, do you have more trouble getting the air in or out during inhalation or exhalation? If it's during inhalation, it's reflux. It's not asthma. And patients will usually tell you, in. And so reactive airway disease or asthma is when the bronchial tubes in the chest contract and it's hard to get the air out. There's a prolonged wheeze. Whereas if the receptors, they are like switches, in the larynx, on the epiglottis, are stimulated by acid, and then the larynx closes down, I guess presumably to keep the stuff out of the lung, because the lung is very, very sensitive. So respiratory reflux is a relatively new term that refers to the idea that reflux can come all the way up into the respiratory tract. So that's the throat and the nose and the ears and then the bronchial tubes, trachea and lungs. The earlier terms were laryngopharyngeal reflux, where you have reflux into the larynx and pharynx. I coined that term. Silent reflux, meaning no heartburn. I coined that term. Airway reflux, which refers to the respiratory tract. I coined that term. But respiratory reflux in the last 2 years has come to be the best term to describe reflux into the airway because it's an intuitive term. So when you say to someone who has breathing problems, you have respiratory reflux, they nod. Or you say the same thing to someone who has problems with chronic throat clearing and sinus. They understand this is all part of the airway and the respiratory tract. I should mention, people ask me all the time, well, how can you have respiratory reflux without having heartburn and indigestion and esophageal problems? And the answer is, the esophagus is robust. It's made for reflux. We all have some reflux, particularly after meals. In fact, 50 reflux episodes a day in the esophagus are considered normal. So the esophagus can take it. One bad reflux episode a week in the throat can be trouble, especially if it sits in a puddle all night in the back of the throat and affects the larynx or dribbles into the lung. So respiratory reflux, the way of thinking about it is that the respiratory lining in the respiratory system is perhaps 1,000 times more sensitive to inflammation and injury by acid and pepsin than the esophagus. So the term respiratory reflux refers to all the symptoms and manifestations of acid reflux into the respiratory tract, and esophageal reflux is heartburn, indigestion, and it refers to what used to be called GERD. So we think esophageal reflux and respiratory reflux represent very, very accurate terms. One other issue that I think needs to be broached before we move on. The gastroenterologists were a starving bunch in 1975 without much. And at that time, the Olympus company began to aggressively market endoscopes, and endoscopy was born. Today, there are 400% more gastroenterologists than there were then. And we've spent about $1 trillion on the endoscopy model. But the model is based upon the presumption that heartburn is reflux and reflux is heartburn and esophageal disease. The reason why I bring this point up is if you are a pulmonologist, if you are an otolaryngologist, if you are an allergist, and you think of reflux, and you send the patient to a gastroenterologist, the gastroenterologist is going to look in the esophagus and to determine whether or not there's reflux, or even do reflux testing in the esophagus. But it doesn't tell you what's happening above. And so in my opinion, in my way of thinking, and based upon a lot of experience and many years doing testing, treating and fixing, correcting, curing patients with reflux, respiratory reflux is bigger than esophageal reflux, and it affects at least 60 million people. So, you know, we're talking here now about a relatively invisible epidemic, and it certainly is associated with sleep apnea and sinus disease and allergies and asthma. In fact, of the asthma patients who come to me, I say, there's the asthma medicine help? They say, no. I say, you can stop it. It's reflux. So we evaluate them, and then they can stop it cold turkey. There's no reason for people to have asthma medications who don't have asthma. So respiratory reflux is a big deal. It's a relative black hole within the medical establishment. Part of it is because of, you know, the heartburn business model of the GIs. And it's going to have to change over the next coming years. I believe primary care physicians are going to need to learn about reflux, including respiratory reflux.
Reflux is very common in the United States. How much of the prevalence would you attribute to the Western diet?
Well, the first question you ask is, we did a study called the Times Square Study. And we went into Times Square, into the tickets line, which meant we got people from all over the country, all over the world, and we interviewed 1,000 Americans, and they weren't like tick-off questions. We asked about questions and medications and which doctors they saw in all of it, and we found that 20% had esophageal reflux, or GERD, which is pretty much the same number you see in the GI literature. But we found another 20% had respiratory reflux. The other finding of the study, the Times Square study, was that we had not much difference between the different age groups. In the 20 to 30-year-old age group, we still found 27% were refluxers. So at this point, it's probably half of America. If you look at obesity and diabetes and all of the other manifestations of bad diet, then of course it's not surprising that many of these refluxers are not only silent, but completely undiagnosed. Of course, the key question is, how much would you attribute to the Western diet? The Western diet, in my opinion, there have been two revolutions in food, one of which is in my lifetime. So when our agriculture was discovered, and wheat was planted, you know, and animals were bred. This happened thousands of years ago. In my lifetime, however, as I told you, my mother cooking clean, fresh food at 6 o'clock. In my lifetime, the big agribusiness and the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA, and I must say, governments are supposed to protect the American people. But when it comes to a choice between consumers or the people and the industry, FDA and USDA have always favored the industry. To the point now, for example, there's something called the Cheeseburger Act. And so all these fast food places were afraid they were going to end up like the cigarette companies. Someone would get obese and they'd get diabetes and they'd sue them. So the Cheeseburger Act say, if you eat this food, you know it's unhealthy. This leads me to the China study. If you look at a map of the China study of the provinces, this is 60,000 people who were studied over an extended period. I don't recall the period, I'm sorry. But you end up with provinces that are red, and you end up with provinces that are green. And the red provinces have diabetes and heart disease and cancer, and the green provinces don't. What's the difference? The red ones eat animals, and the green ones don't. China never had reflux until all of the fast food, there's a massive epidemic of reflux in China as the Western diet has reached it. So reflux is the tip of an iceberg that includes obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and all of it's related. There's a movie called What the Health. In that movie, they point out that processed meats are a class one carcinogen, according to the World Health Organization, in the same category as plutonium, asbestos, and cigarette smoking. So the question of what's wrong with our diet? Pretty much everything.
And how can patients who are accustomed to a Western diet modify their lifestyle to treat and ultimately cure reflux?
Well, the first problem is that patients assume that physicians know something about nutrition and diet, and they don't. The average physician knows nothing. The average physician believes that people are stupid and non-compliant. So if they try to put them on a weight loss program, or any kind of a program, it's not going to work. I've taken the position over the last many years that the diet for life is lean, clean, green, and alkaline. Lean means now not only not red meat, but it also means limiting other meats and no processed meats. Clean means no chemicals. If you look on the back of your energy bar and there are 32 chemicals you can't pronounce, get it out of your diet. Green means organic, although organic now is a questionable title. Everything that's organic is not organic, and everything that's organic is not clean. But it also, green implies fruits and vegetables. And finally, alkaline. I mean, if you have reflux, going on a grapefruit diet or having acid in your diet, like apple cider vinegar, is not a good idea. So that we recommend that. Now, it's a paradigm shift. Remember I said that there were two revolutions. The first revolution was the discovery of farming and of agriculture. The second is the destruction of the American food system for profit with the help of the government. I hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but if you watch television and look at the double cheeseburger with the triple cheese and bacon, and think coronary artery disease and diabetes, you're right. And then the next ad comes up, it's a chalupa with the cheese dripping out of the fatty meat, and you say to yourself, cancer. You're right. And by the way, the two biggest lobbyists that give millions and millions and millions of dollars to Congress are agriculture and pharmaceuticals. Furthermore, if you look at the American Heart Association, who do you suppose gives them money? The beef industry and the dairy industry. If you look at the American Diabetes, who gives them money? So there are major conflicts of interest, major political forces behind a diet designed to keep America sick.
As a final thought, what key takeaway do you want to leave our audience with?
Well, I'm going to tell you a personal story. I had a wonderful opportunity to go to a meeting where I received an award, and I got to speak people who had, quote, changed medicine. They gave me time to speak about my work. And after I was the last speaker, I went upstairs to the restaurant with some friends. And I said out loud, you know, my biggest disappointment, I've not had a greater impact on my colleagues. And this young woman stood up, her name is Julie Way, and she put her hands on her hips. And she said, Jamie Kaufman, 5 years ago, at this meeting, at this very hotel, I took you out to lunch and you changed my practice. And then I had a mumble from a woman, two women down said, me too. And I looked at them both. They were both well-known pediatric otolaryngologists. And I said, Eureka, I've been wanting to write a book on acid reflux in children. And so we made the outline that day, and we went to work, and the book is actually up for pre-sale on Amazon. Listen to the title. It's not just acid reflux in children. It's acid reflux in children. How healthy eating can fix your child's asthma, allergies, obesity, nasal congestion, cough, and croup. So the idea that we have tens of millions of children that are born healthy and all of them by age three are sick doesn't make any sense. So as I began doing my research, I thought, boy, you know, I don't know that much about kids. I stopped seeing kids more than 10 years ago, and I better do some research. So, you know, someone had told me, well, maybe milk is in fact good for kids. So I began looking at the literature on milk. And it's probably not so good for kids. And then I began looking at other dairy. I, by the way, was gluten-free and dairy-free for many years due to other issues, including gluten ataxia and psoriasis. Anyway, all that cleared up. So to make a long story short, I kept going. I read the China study. And then I watched three movies. The three movies were Food, Inc., What the Health, and Forks Over Knives. And then I went vegan. So the third revolution that's coming is veganism. And veganism is overtaking the country. And the reason it's overtaking the country is because of millennials. It's young people, particularly young people with children. Why is vegan special? Number one, you can reverse disease. And, oh, by the way, back to my 70th birthday, which is in November, my family dies of stroke. I wanted to have my carotids looked at, and I didn't have any plaque in my carotids, but I had intimal thickening, which is like stage one hardening of the arteries. So when I watched What the Health, they showed this picture of a doctor who had a bad looking coronary artery, and after 1 year on a whole plant-based diet, gone, normal artery. So the idea that the inflammatory and plaque process and degenerative process, which may very well include things like Alzheimer's, is potentially reversible, said I want to save myself. My problem is I'm in my prime at age 70, and so I feel as though I have 20 more years that I have to be active and working. And so for this reason, I bought in, and I've been vegan now since about April. The difference has been so dramatic. I've had five back surgeries, including an L3-4-5 fusion. I now walk upright. I live with less pain. My shoulder problems, my psoriasis, everything's better. But the most important thing that's better is my brain. I don't have brain fog. I mean, that 5 minutes in the morning before you, you know, have a sip of coffee or whatever. No brain fog, better writing, greater energy. Greater energy for exercising, which is making me stronger. I've put on muscle mass. I've actually gained weight on a vegan diet. And so for this reason, the young generation is pushing us. In New York, I get my lunch. We all got our lunch from a place that's vegan. And that little place that's vegan apparently won whatever it is you win on Shark Tank and will be a national chain. So it's my belief that vegetarianism and vegan in particular, meaning you don't cheat, you know, that's called chegan if you are a vegan except you cheat, is what's coming. And so if someone said to me, what is the healthy diet for which you can live a long life, avoiding your genetic predispositions to whatever it is, cancer or strokes, that this is the way of the future. And I make all my patients watch the movie, and I have the discussion with them. And some of them do it, and some of them don't. You know, you can lead a horse to water. But you can't have your cake and eat it, too. You can't eat whatever you want whenever you want to eat it and stay healthy in this country anymore. That ship sailed. And the proton pump inhibitors, they're not going to save you either. So those are my final thoughts.
Thank you very much for sharing your story with us and speaking with us about nutrition.
Reflux is everywhere, and doctors need to pay attention to people's, and nutritionists, by the way, a lot of the periodicals that are being written for you are being written for you by the beef and lamb and dairy industry. You need to go beyond the material you're being given. It's an important, important issue.
Absolutely. Thank you again for speaking with us today, Dr. Kaufman.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.